Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the Triple Entente Beer Summit edition. I'm Shane Harris of the Daily Beast, and we've got a special treat for you this week. It is our second live show. We got together with some of our sister podcasts, the Lawfare Podcast and the Steptoe Cyber Podcast, this week in the Washington, D.C. neighborhood of Bloomingdale at the Old Engine 12 restaurant, lovingly known to locals like me as the Firehouse. This was the second time, of course, that we've gotten together, and we had a great turnout and a lot to discuss with our friends who came to sit in the audience. This week, of course, we had new developments in the battle over unlocking an iPhone used in the San Bernardino shootings. We had revelations of a cyber war plan that the U.S. developed against Iran, and news on the countering violent extremism front. I really think you're going to like the show. Thanks for tuning in, and we will be back with you next week with our regular program.
Welcome to the Triple Entente Beer Summit here at the Washington Firehouse. This is with Shane Harris. Shane, say hello.
Hello, I'm Shane Harris of Rational Security. Good to be here.
And Ben Wittes.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast.
And Tamara Wittes.
Hi, I'm Tamara Wittes of Rational Security.
And Alan Cohn.
Hi, I'm Alan Cohn of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast.
And I'm Stuart Baker, holding the record for returning to the Beer Summit more times than any other lawyer. We're also here with a great audience, and we will be turning over the last portion of the show to the audience and their questions. But let's jump right in the issue. I guess I should say the Rational Security Podcast is famous for the people who do not sponsor them, and this segment of the podcast is not brought to you by Apple and the iOS. Why don't we start out by talking about the biggest security issue of the day, which is Apple's the bitter fight to avoid providing access to law enforcement to one of the San Bernardino shooter's iPhones. Ben, why don't you introduce the topic?
Well, so Apple, 2 days ago, we thought had gotten itself out of this particular confrontation with the government. There had been a litigation in the Eastern District of New York last year in which Apple refused to help give material from a seized phone. That case kind of withered away, and we thought it was the sort of shot not taken in the going dark debate. And then yesterday, or 2 days ago, the FBI and the Justice Department came forward with what is really, I think, one of the more remarkable briefs to come out of the Justice Department in the years that I have covered the Justice Department as either a journalist or an analyst. And basically saying that since the San Bernardino shootings, they have had one of the shooter's phones. They have the consent of the owner of the phone, which was the employer of the shooter. They have a warrant, so there's no legal problem. And they have a means of getting into the phone, which requires exactly one thing of Apple. And that is that Apple disable the number of password attempts that you can make before the phone does its sort of Mission Impossible self-destruct. And that Apple refuses to do that. And the result is, now that it's gone to the court for an All Writs Act order, for technical assistance to force Apple to do that, and Apple has responded with a, really quite bitter and, dramatic statement from Tim Cook that they will fight this, and you can see the sort of Cupertino pitchforks and torches lit and bared. I think we're headed for a real showdown between the company and the Justice Department now.
So, Shane, let me ask you, to the extent that anybody here has contact with the real world, I think it's probably you, what is the reaction in the real world to this? Is this seen as Apple standing up for our civil liberties and I'm glad I pay $200 more than my phone is worth because they do that? Or are people saying, what? This is terrorism, and you can do it. You should just do it.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, just anecdotally, I will say, I mean, I've been covering the story this week a bit, but I've been surprised by the number of conversations I've actually had with friends who generally are very skeptical of government surveillance authority, who just said, I think Apple's wrong. I was actually surprised by that. I think there's a lot of, again, this is not a scientific sample, but I mean, there certainly must be out there in the public, to some extent, people who feel like this is an important case. This is an ISIS agent, or at least ISIS-inspired person in the United States who murdered, 14 people, I mm-hmm. believe, in a major terrorist attack in the United States. There's clearly a compelling interest in getting the information. And I'm not really sure whether or not Apple has kind of really articulated what is, you know, at stake from their perspective in this and maybe overcome some of that. I mean, the headlines have really been more about, you know, ISIS will not unlock terrorist phone. Well, what I found was so interesting, though, in covering this week, is if you go back and you look at the history of Apple's compliance with the government when it's served with an order to unlock an iPhone, they've historically been very compliant with that. I think it's some 70 times by the government's estimate since 2008 that they've actually unlocked iPhones.
So what they're saying is those cases we were willing to help, but now that you come to us with the biggest mass killing by terrorists in the United States since 9/11, and no, we don't think so.
They're not exactly saying that, surprisingly, no. But, you know, and this is a different case. It's a different operating system. It would require Apple doing more things to the phone to unlock it and get the data than it has in previous cases. But essentially, the government is still asking the same thing, which is get us the information on the phone. And Ben alluded to this previous case from 2015 that was sort of withering away, where Apple kind of, for the first time in 70 times, raised an objection and said, no, we don't want to do this anymore. And I don't think it's quite fleshed out what happened there. But this is a really profound case that has, you know, implications far beyond just the San Bernardino case. I'm really surprised by what I'm sure the FBI considers its good fortune, that finally the case where you make a stand on the so-called dreaded going dark program is not just some phone of some nobody who was involved in, you know, maybe a petty crime or even a drug deal. It's the San Bernardino killer. I mean, this really is, the stakes could not be higher for this.
Although I do think it's worth noting that last week, in an almost unnoticed, except by Susan Hennessy, who's sitting over there, comment in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Comey, the FBI director, gave another example that I think is really powerful and striking in a completely different way. It's an example of a 8-month pregnant woman in Louisiana who is murdered, and the local police have no leads on who killed her, except that she was found with her phone, which is an iPhone that they can't unlock. And so they literally have no basis to proceed in the investigation. And so I think between those two examples, you actually see kind of vividly the range of the going dark problem in a sort of non-hypothetical way that was sort of not available 2 months ago.
So let me ask you this. The argument that Apple makes is this capability doesn't exist now, and if we are forced to create it, we will loose it on the world and it will be used by evil governments and others to get access to iPhones everywhere, destroying the security of iPhone users. And I've heard people take quite seriously the idea that once we do this, China and Russia will be right behind ordering Apple to do the same thing.
You know, can I just step in on that as someone who's spent a bit of time hanging out in autocratic regimes?
They're your favorite vacation spots.
Yeah, they are. But, you know, what dissidents in these countries will tell you is that if they get picked up by the cops and suspected, yes, immediately the cops take their phone. And you know what they do next?
Rubber hose cryptography.
Right. They say, give me your passcode.
Right.
So they're not waiting with bated breath
for Apple's special
scope
new technology
of the All Writs Act to
exactly
be determined.
So, you know, it seems to me that's a bit of a red herring argument. Also, of course, these autocratic governments are monitoring what their citizens are posting on Facebook, what they're posting on Twitter. If they can, they already try to get to the servers through which they send email. So I have to ask, how much does Apple's end-to-end encryption really help?
But I think we may be not going beyond the bounds of our table here. Not surprised that Shane didn't have more on the fact that there's a huge constituency of people who believe that Apple is doing not only exactly the right thing, but the thing they're waiting for somebody to stand up and do on their behalf, which is to say that governments don't have a place in these phones. Now, leaving aside the merits, which we'll debate extensively, I think we do have to recognize that there is a constituency of people who believe that's a legitimate position for the company to be taking.
They believe that they want somebody to take that position, but I don't think that's necessarily the same thing as it being a legitimate position for a company to take. They want this symbolic gesture of somebody standing up and shaking their fist at the man.
Well, that would be everybody who voted for Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. It's a pretty big group.
Big constituency.
So Ben Wittes here. I think there's a very deep truth in that, and it is the idea that I've been flirting with for the last couple of weeks is that there's a very precise analogy between Apple and the crypto libertarian constituencies and the gun manufacturers and Second Amendment enthusiasts. And the analogy works like this. These are both device manufacturers, product manufacturers of products that there is some constitutional entitlement to use and that has very legitimate defensive purposes, that also have collateral consequences for public safety that are non-trivial, that whose enthusiasts and systematically discount the consequences to those public safety issues, and who make a very, very deep judgment that their ability to use these devices is the paramount definition of liberty over and above anything else that any interest may have. And I think that's that relationship between, and that Congress has given a in every other context, bizarre degree of immunity to the manufacturers for the behavior of third parties using their products. And I think there really is a deep relationship between Apple and a constituency of people who believe in a kind of libertarian approach to these technologies that is worth taking very seriously. It's going to be a huge political impediment to any approach other than a laissez-faire one.
So what you're getting at is the idea that there's a kind of, this is a little bit more derogatory than I mean it, but a kind of tribal connection between the consumers and the company, and it's a way of symbolically expressing identity to use and enter into either a crypto culture or a gun culture.
I think if you take an NRA statement and an EFF statement about encryption and you redact key words, the average person in this room would have a very hard time determining which was the statement about the right to use cryptography and which was the statement about the right to own guns.
Although ironically, I think, and this is Alan, the Second Amendment enthusiasts and the gun manufacturers would find more constitutional footing for their position than the manufacturer of the iPhone.
Right, because in this case, I mean, all of the constitutional protections and then some are already available to the government to get access to the phone.
Right, and the individual the individual whose privacy rights would ultimately be violated no longer has those rights and didn't have them from the beginning because it was not his device, and he was clearly on notice that he did not have a privacy interest in the activities that he transacted on the phone.
Well, you know, because his, among other things, his employer has said, it's our phone, go ahead and look at it. And this is kind of interesting, and for those of you who want to persuade your employers that this is not a this is a reason not to support Apple, what Apple is saying is not only screw the U.S. government, but screw your employers too. We're with the employees, and if the employer buys the phone, it's still the employee who gets to lock it, and if the employee dies or heads off to Brazil with half the funds in the company, we're not going to help the employer get into the phone.
Or if the individual says, I'm going to use the phone in 10 minutes to destroy the network of the employer
right.
who owns the phone, we find ourselves in the same position.
It'll be interesting what happens when that employer is Apple.
So let me ask.
Not that that's inciting in any way action by Apple employees.
Certainly not. So now Apple's raised the stakes. They've taken an issue that was already very polarized in terms of the government industry conversation, and they've made this very public, very symbolic political argument. And as Ben and Susan point out in their post on Lawfare today, this really dumps it in the lap of Congress, and it heightens the imperative for Congress to act. So Congress is going to be acting on this presumably in an election year, in an environment where the American public post-San Bernardino is expressing a lot of fear. It strikes me that maybe Apple didn't have very good political timing in upping the ante right now.
Well, maybe, unless you think that they believe that all publicity on this issue is good for them, which I think that's what they believe.
But I also think, and I've gotten quizzical looks on this, so you feel free to give them more tonight, is that they're also heading into a moment on the other side where the Supreme Court's already begun to opine on the idea that the smartphone is different. The smartphone is not your briefcase. The smartphone is not your telephone. The smartphone is like your house. The smartphone is like the inner sanctum of your house, where your things you're entitled to the most amount of privacy.
It's your cat videos.
I have a right to privacy for my cat videos.
Go ahead.
No. So I would just say that I'm not sure that Apple has misjudged the moment. I think it points out yet again, and Stuart's analogy to the Trump-Sanders successes in the early primaries go, that Apple may have realized or may just be a player in a larger drama that shows just a stark division in thinking among different elements of the populace.
As a procedural matter, I mean, Apple has till Tuesday, I think, to respond to the judge in this case. The warrant's been issued. They have a chance to respond. If the judge in that case, and as I say many times in the podcast, I'm not a lawyer, decides, nope, you've got to do this, got to execute the warrant, that's it, and Apple says no, who's in contempt? Does Tim Cook get thrown in a jail cell until they comply?
Though the company could be held in contempt and just fined, and the most effective fines I've seen are the ones that say it'll be $10,000 today and $20,000 tomorrow and $40,000 the next.
Which
day.
I would imagine Apple would welcome the opportunity
well,
to pay that fine.
Well, once it gets up to $1 billion, it starts to hurt.
Well, I mean, how long is that going to take? That's a long time.
Well, 30 days is my guess.
Well, could the judge fine you $1 billion a day in contempt?
Well, it is a company with $215 billion of cash on hand.
Yeah, exactly.
This could be interesting. Okay. It could be quite a waiting game.
I don't think that will happen, but at some point they will say, okay, we lost.
Right, and they'll go on with it. And I just think that if there is a grand strategy on Apple's part playing out here, and one presumes there probably is, because this is a company that's all about public image and reputation, I'd have to imagine that maybe Tim Cook has looked at this and said, yeah, we may lose this in the courts, but we may win this reputationally. And, you know, they have, in fact, staked a claim saying, if you make us do this, it could harm our business reputation, which is a very interesting, you know, rationale for not having to comply with a warrant. I'm not sure the judge is going to find that persuasive. But
the other thing that's going on here is this is an old iPhone, and this fix is only good for the old iPhone. If you wanted to get into a modern iPhone,
it's a 5C, right? If you want to get into a 6, yeah,
you would have to. I don't understand the Apple ecosystem because I'm not.
Everyone in the crowd is now pulling out their phones and trying to figure out which.
I'm so glad you didn't upgrade, right?
Really, get an Android. Really, it's cheaper and it works just as well. And remarkably, Google has been bullied into saying something nice about Apple, but they've been surprisingly measured in their praise for Apple's stance. So my guess is they are a little bit disappointed about the way this is playing out. But Apple has already built technology that will be even harder, though not impossible, for Apple to get into on behalf of law enforcement the next time this happens. All right, let's turn to, speaking of getting into things, the New York Times and a new film that is just debuting has told the story of something called Nitro Zeus, which was apparently an enormous campaign, according to the film and according to the New York Times since, an enormous campaign to break everything in Iran if we had to go to battle stations with Iran as an alternative to letting Israel bomb nuclear facilities around the country. Shane, you've covered this story. Can you give us a little more detail on that?
Yeah. So Nitro Zeus, which it sounds like an energy drink, or a pro wrestler, I'm not sure. But I just love the names, by the way, the code names people come up with. So, yes, this
was... The smell of Nitro Zeus.
Yeah, Nitro Zeus. This sounds very serious. This is a plan that was going to be developed and put into effect by U.S. Cyber Command, which was basically, should the negotiations with Iran over the nuclear problem break down, we kind of had this in our pocket. And it'll sound to a lot of people like Stuxnet and the Olympic Games program, where NSA and Israel are believed to have developed a computer worm known as Stuxnet that goes in and disables centrifuges in the Natanz enrichment facility. But this sort of took it even farther. We were going to get into the Fordo facility. We were going to shut down the telecommunication system in Iran, the power grid. You know, basically what you would imagine sort of an all-out, you know, campaign of cyber war and destruction on critical infrastructure in Iran, which raised, you know, many interesting questions like, is that collateral damage to civilian populations? Is this an act of war? It's a little hard for me to discern from the early reporting on this and the sort of sneak peeks of the documentary film, which is done by a well-known documentarian named Alex Gibney, and who I know is producer on this, has worked on this for a couple of years now, so I'm looking forward to it, how serious this was, how far along it was, how much of this sort of was pie in the sky. But you know, it was a plan on the shelf, and at how close we got to it, we may have to do that.
They spent hundreds of millions of dollars on it.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's
a real deal. But I mean, I guess the question is, you know, at what point, I mean, how close did we get to pulling the trigger on it is one thing that I would really like to know. But what I'm just struck by is two things. One, there was a part of me that was not surprised at all by this, because this is what the NSA and Cyber Command do. We map critical infrastructure. We figure out how to take out people's power grids. We figure out how to use these capabilities. So there's a part that says, well, sure, we did something like this. It's good. It was good that we had that. And the other is, holy crap, you know, do we almost actually come to the point where we were going to basically take Iran offline?
So this
and
is
imagine what that would have been like.
But wait a minute. We're burying the big question.
The lead.
Where did the name Nitro Zeus come from? Because that's what everybody here wants to know.
Is it from the random military operation name generator?
Well, I hope so.
I think it's like the best name.
So there's a whole family of malware named after Zeus. But none of it is Nitro Zeus.
But this is Nitro Zeus. I mean, this is some serious-ass Zeus.
But what is, since it's out, what is surprising everyone at the table about the fact that the U.S. government created a campaign plan for a potential military operation and that it costs a couple hundred million dollars to flip the meter once you start doing a campaign plan?
That sounds cheap, right? That sounds like a bargain.
Well, it's a lot cheaper than a conventional strike.
Sure.
Yeah. It occurs to me that as we put together Stuxnet, which actually happened, and this, which was ramped up in 2009, the Obama administration must have come in And in the way of new administrations, determined not to do all the stupid things that the last guys did, but to do new stupid things. They found this capability, which had not been exposed, and fell in love with it. It was used in Stuxnet, and then they said, wow, if it works in Stuxnet, we can do it in a really big way. And then Harold Koh at the State Department and perhaps some others started to say, oh, wait a minute, you know, this is disproportionate. This could cause civilian harm. Maybe this is not a weapon you should be using. And I gather that that was a big part of the debate that may have held up deployment of this, or at least use of it for a significant period of time.
All right, so show of hands or volume of applause from the audience. Do you guys find this totally unsurprising? All right, so who looks at Nitro Zeus and says, wow, that's surprising? We got one.
We got one.
I think the not surprising.
You're a protest vote.
That's right.
I'm a Trump voter. Right. Okay, so I want to say one thing about this is Wittes again. I want to say one thing about Alex Gibney, which is
the filmmaker.
The filmmaker. He did his movie about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange is one of the best pieces of filmmaking I have ever seen in the documentary national security space. And he clearly went into it with the idea that he was going to do some kind of hagiography, and the facts led him in a very different direction. And he followed it, and it's an incredibly moving and interesting film that gives him a lot of credibility with me in taking on a subject like this.
And his producer, we should just say, Javier Potero, who is on this. I mean, I've known him for a couple of years now, and he has talked to all the right people. So I think that the reporting on this immediately has a patina of credibility.
It's amazing to keep a secret like that
for
years while you're doing post-production editing. It's remarkable.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a credit to them as for being good journalists that as they're talking to people, and they surely must have realized that some people must have been out there on this, that it didn't get out sooner. I mean, it's a hell of a scoop. I mean, I wish I had it.
Yeah, it's an it's an incredible story. I have to ask the lawyers at the table, though. This was apparently being prepared, debated, at the same time that the administration more broadly is trying to figure out how to develop norms around cyber warfare or the non-use of cyber warfare, and is dealing with that issue, you know, with respect to countries like China that it worries could present a real threat to American infrastructure. So how do you think this story relates to the norm development around this issue? And did the administration care about that?
That was what the State Department was doing. They said, we're trying to build norms around this that say you don't do certain things. And now you've given us a war plan that says, we might do some of those things. Come on. And this is exactly the problem with letting the State Department participate in war planning.
We hate international law.
Well, because they announce aspirational goals for what international law could be on a really good day, and then they say, and we're going to be living by those rules even if it costs us the next war. This is not great military planning.
Well, so then is that the buried lead? Not so much that the plan existed, but how did the debates play out? And I'd be curious how many people think, number one, this was an example of great, you know, wrought, you know, kind of debate at the highest levels amongst peacetime norms and wartime planning, or was it simply just the balkanization of the policy process the two things to go on simultaneously?
I'm guessing that half those hundreds of millions of dollars was spent to satisfy the State Department that we really were living up to the norms. Okay, last topic before we let the audience in. Tamara, countering violent extremism, that's been something that this administration has prided itself on being more enthusiastic about than the Bush administration, which was surprisingly enthusiastic about it. And there's been a lot of talk about efforts to change the direction and build a new countering violent extremism initiative. Can you take us into this issue?
Sure. So on Tuesday morning, Tony Blinken, the Deputy Secretary of State, gave a speech at Brookings and rolled out a new countering violent extremism, or CVE, strategy for state and USAID, and more broadly for the U.S. government. And I think it comes out of a couple of things. I mean, the administration is often criticized by Republicans who say, well, this whole label CVE is silly. You got to be able to name the enemy of Islamism.
I do keep thinking, you know, maybe that's my drugstore.
Right.
I feel violent and extreme every time I go into CVS.
Right. But I think
what radicalize you on the line.
What the label does recognize is that it's not just the terrorism, in other words, the behavior that we're targeting. There's an ecosystem here that we have to target, and so as this administration kind of found itself going back into Iraq to fight ISIS, realizing that there was a new wave to struggle with, and it's been saying, okay, this is going to be a generational battle. Well, then you got to create the infrastructure for a generational battle beyond the military piece. And that, so that's what this was meant to unveil. There were five pillars of this strategy that Blinken laid out, including a new counter messaging, or at least a relabeled counter messaging effort in the State Department, now called the Global Engagement Center. New research, notably social science research, folks, to understand the drivers of extremism. And actually, I found it refreshingly honest in Blinken's remarks, the extent to which he admitted that we don't know what drives radicalization. There are tons of hypotheses, but none of them have very good data, and so we need to do more thinking about this. How radical. New partnerships below the level of central governments, working with local communities, working with local governments, new money for programs to address the underlying conditions that seem to put people at risk of radicalization. But what really got me about the speech beyond the programmatic stuff was this bit at the end, which, Stuart, you referenced the Bush administration's effort. It was more reminiscent of the Bush administration's thinking than anything I've heard from this administration on counterterrorism and CVE so far. And I'll just read you a couple of sentences from the end of Blinken's remarks. He said, "Ultimately, at the heart of our strategy, at the center of each of these five pillars, is a commitment to the principles that have underwritten an unprecedented era of greater peace and prosperity over the last seven decades. Principles of good governance and pluralism, of the rule of law and fundamental freedoms, of human rights and human dignity." And then he warns about governments and leaders who use counterterrorism as an excuse to crack down. Says it fuels extremism, and he quotes President Obama saying the essential ingredient to real and lasting stability and progress is not less democracy, it is more democracy. Well, that sure sounded like a war of ideas to me.
Sounds to me like you're going to get the guys who wrote your fifth grade civics textbook and give them Twitter accounts.
Right, so like what does it mean in practice? I mean, you know, is this a bureaucratic rearranging of as you said on rational security, deck chairs on the Titanic, or as you might say in a more optimistic mode, a sort of bureaucratic rearranging of the flow chart, or is there a substantive point that meaningfully underlies it that you can look at as policy change?
You know, look, I think the Bush administration had an explicit premise that democracy would be an antidote to terrorism. And they talked about, you know, the whole freedom agenda was about trying to dry up the swamp. That was the justification. And I don't think there was ever a lot of empirical support for that hypothesis. And in any event, it didn't get a very good test. So they're reviving the hypothesis, but you know, I guess I have to wonder, do they mean it in that broad ideological sense that they believe openness and tolerance and pluralism makes people more resistant to the appeals of terrorists? Or is it simply just a caveat of the overall strategy, which is we're going to keep working with the Egyptians and the Saudis and the Emiratis and all these other autocratic governments. Just, guys, don't take advantage, please.
So I have a completely different theory about what causes radicalization, and I'm delighted that for the first time I can cite the good wife on the podcast, because there was a great moment, really tiny, and you could easily miss it, where one of the bad girls is talking to one of the good girls, and she says, "Oh, I can tell you how to get your parents to give you anything you want. Just play 2 minutes of this CD." And she puts the CD on, and it is an Islamic call to prayer.
And
that's it. They just move on. But, you know, the idea that this is an act of adolescent rebellion. This is the thing your parents are scared of. So, by God, you ought to embrace it. And that has enormous appeal. It's kind of goth for the 2015s. I think the key to kind of taking away that appeal is mockery. People should, you know, you should make them look like idiots, and that then they can't be the hot guys anymore. They can't be the hot chicks. They are the idiots. So
it's
that would
be a massive
my
campaign of trolling.
Exactly. No, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So they
should put you in trouble. We should get that Russian troll farm to go to work on this.
We need a job for you.
Me and Chris Segoyan together at last. All right. Any other comments on CVE, or can we open it up to the audience and questions?
I'll just throw out one last way to interpret this new effort, which is that CVE is now the development programming flavor of the month, and that counterterrorism is the new way to justify budget for nighttime basketball, education programs, job programs, you know, adolescent welfare programs, Stuart.
Midnight basketball at last is back.
So tomorrow, this great. This binds the whole Triple Entente Beer Summit podcast together. All we need to do is call the Justice Department's brief on an Apple, an exercise in countering violent extremism, Apple will have to comply.
There we go. All right.
Everybody wins.
Thank you for that wrap up, Ben Wittes. And now, at last, we are going to hear from people who collectively, for sure, and probably individually, are smarter than the panelists. So with that...
At least we hope so.
We also invite your invitation to mockery at the microphone.
Yeah, this is your chance to mock any of us with impunity. There is a microphone.
Well, you can mock it. You can mock Ben with impunity, and you can mock me, but don't count on impunity.
There is a microphone right here, but you have to get up and walk over to it. It actually does not have legs.
All right, we have.
But you have
one
legs.
Brave
come
man.
On up,
a brave soul.
Come forward and introduce yourself, please.
Just turn it around.
Yeah. I am David.
Hey, David.
Hey, David.
I work at a think tank called Third Way. So I have two questions. Looking beyond this single app case, which we know is not necessarily about encryption per se,
right,
toward the broader encryption debate, first question, telecom companies always get what they want. Do we have a reason to believe internet companies aren't going to get what they want? Now, recently with net neutrality, the telecom companies aren't winning. But with the FAA, they got retroactive immunity. They tend to win. Why won't that happen with Google, Facebook, and Apple? And the second question is, there's no data on how often encryption is a problem. We have the Chattanooga case, we have the pregnant woman, we have San Bernardino, and then we have Cyrus Vance saying 74 iPhones in a period. He doesn't say whether the iPhones prevented any further investigation. Is anyone trying to compile a better database that shows us the cost and benefits of encryption? Because if we don't know the costs and benefits, how can we construct policy that weighs the costs and benefits? And those are the
great questions. Sounds like a great lawfare project, then.
I was just gonna comment on the first question, and you're right to, by the way, bring up that this is not necessarily an encryption debate per se, insofar as the government's not asking Apple to decrypt the phone, they're asking it to hack the phone. But, you know, if Apple were a telecommunications company, it would have to comply. I mean, under CALEA, it would have to do that. And in fact, in the New York case from last year, it goes about saying, like, well, look, under CALEA, we're actually an information services provider. So we don't really, you can't really, I guess they're trying to get at the argument of whether they can be compelled to provide technical assistance, under law, which I gather the All Writs statute is sort of there to kind of be a stopgap to that. But I mean, I think the heart of your question is, you know, they're a big, huge, powerful company, and aren't they going to prevail because they have political influence and they have reputation? And, you know, I wonder about that too. I mean, you know, I would imagine if you're the magistrate in this case, you're treading very carefully on this, no?
So I think I have a couple thoughts on both questions. On the first question, I actually think the premise of the question is not correct. The idea that the telecoms always win, to the extent that it's true, it is also true that the telecoms have a legally mandated, very close relationship that requires them to do certain things. And in exchange for it, they get all kinds of immunities and protections. But these issues don't arise with the telecoms because there's CALEA. Right? And because Congress said, A, you have to help, and B, we'll pay you to do it. And if anyone sues you, you win. And the same thing happened in the FISA Amendments Act, right? Like, you know, to a certain extent with the internet companies. But I think the question is, like, from the government's point of view, the government would love to have a relationship with the internet companies that's a lot more like the relationship with the telcos, which is to say, tightly integrated, they function as arms when needed of investigative authority, and they are protected in law in 100 ways, as you describe. On your second question, the FBI has spent a lot of time trying to come up with, you know, they've been asked, and I think fairly, to show what the need and what the use case, what the real cases are. And it's a very hard thing to do, because if you have a bunch of problems that eventually got solved by other means, you don't necessarily, that, you know, if you eventually cracked a case and it took a long time, and you know that there was this phone that you couldn't get into that may have caused it to be a 2-day case rather than a 2-year case, you're not willing to say the fact that we got a good outcome in that case eventually means there's no problem. You feel like there was a real problem, and yet when you draw attention to that case, somebody says, wait a minute, you got a conviction with a 40-year sentence. What's the problem? But from the internal perception of where the problem was, and the fact that the problem may have had some other resolution makes it very hard to count. In addition, a lot of the cases are still pending, right? They're continuing to look for answers, and the fact that they don't really know what's on the phone of that dead woman in Louisiana, right? Maybe the answer is nothing. There's no good lead on it. Same with San Bernardino. So you have this problem of but-for causation. When you put those two problems together, it's very hard to come up with a list of the cases that would be different if things, you know, if the rules were different.
So I will offer just one mildly mischievous suggestion. It's very hard, for reasons Ben has expressed, to do a public weighing of costs and benefits. But if you wanted the costs and benefits to be weighed by somebody who could measure them quite clearly, you should do something that Senator Whitehouse has suggested. Just make the companies that manufacture the products or release the encryption liable for any crimes and acts of terrorism that are enabled by the products that they have sold. And then they will internalize the benefits of all the privacy that they're providing, and they'll internalize the costs as well. So, you know, we don't have to do a big debate. We can just let them decide which is more important.
The problem is, of course, then you end up criminalizing the activities of, I don't know, like telephone providers and airlines and people who make cash, you know, things like that.
It is a mischievous suggestion.
I, a lawyer? But I do think the other point is, and I think I think just to be fair, we have the luxury of kind of playing around with this idea of, well, how many times is this happening right now? I think to really engage in the public policy debate, you have to start from the assumption that there are and will be an increasing number of crimes and potentially terrorist incidents that involve individuals' use of encrypted communications to communicate, to plot, to carry out attacks. With that assumption, what is the balancing of interests with respect to the proper public policy? Because although I think that that is a question that's worth engaging, the question of really how often is this happening is not one that's going to be worth asking for very long.
And there's that old saw, you know, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. And the people who are victimized by encryption are probably experiencing the future faster than the rest of us. Okay, next question.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I'm Graham Markowitz. I'm a law student and U.S. Army veteran. It seems implausible or at least inconsistent that we, as the U.S. government, can shut down Iran but not unlock a two-year-old iPhone 5C. Can you reconcile that for me?
Well... I mean, we may have the capability to unlock an iPhone 5C and just don't necessarily want to use it in this case. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, I've heard in the discussion, you know, people who are opposed, you know, I think they've said this somewhat facetiously, to forcing Apple to hand over the contents, we'll just give it to the NSA and let them do it. Like we would really want the NSA to intervene in a domestic criminal case. I mean, and the NSA, by the way, would not want to do that either. So, you know, it's possible. You know, and to your point, there is a very interesting, and we keep going back to this New York case involving Apple, where they wouldn't unlock an earlier version with running iPhone operating system 7. And the judge in that case pointed to yet another case where it was revealed that Homeland Security digital forensics experts actually think that they have and have used a system that can unlock an iPhone 7 and possibly an iPhone 8. And it was kind of like, wait, where did that come from? And it's this very strange little exchange that happened in a totally unnoticed case. But yeah, maybe that they do in fact have that capability and just do not want to use it here. And I think the FBI and the Justice Department, I presume, are interested in probing, you know, this case and the edges of what the law allows to get precedent on this, and would rather be able to do it legally than having to rely on the guys at Fort Meade to crack it every time.
I also think the easy reconciliation of your question is that Iran has not yet upgraded to iOS.
Don't tell them.
Although the other thing that's interesting from the reporting, though, is that in each case there is a discussion about the unintended consequences and the collateral damages in each. In the San Bernardino iPhone case, there's concern that, you know, we might get it wrong and accidentally delete all the data. And in the Iran case, there's a concern that, you know, we might get it wrong and it might knock out the entire power grid and take the entire country offline. But there's strangely more angst about making a mistake in the San Bernardino case than there is in the Iran case. So,
can I just go on record, by the way, as saying that the Nitro Seuss plan sounds effing crazy? Like, you don't do that. You know, that's an act of war. Really?
Well, yeah.
Come on.
It's an act of war. That's why you would
just
do it.
Bomb a facility. Don't take the freaking power.
That's why you write a war plan.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. That's true. But like, seriously, that's cuckoo town. Very cool, but crazy.
Okay. Next.
Hi. I wanted to ask two attached questions.
Give us your name.
Will Carter from CSIS. And I wanted to ask two questions about the Apple case. One is, as much as people have drawn parallels between historical capabilities under CALEA to wiretap phone conversations, accessing someone's device, which can store data that they never intended to send through a third-party network, is different. Mm-hmm. And should this be looked at differently? And also, if you set a precedent that tech companies should be expected to create a bespoke piece of software at law enforcement's request under the All Writs Act to access a device, is that different than building a capability into a software product in order to facilitate surveillance? Curious about those.
Good questions.
Well, it kind of goes to your point, yeah, Alan, that it's not just a phone.
Right. Somebody's been reading Riley. So.
Right. So can I just say that I don't know anybody who thinks that, like, it's a great idea, a good thing, to rely on the All Writs Act to do this very challenging And everybody, I think, in a, you know, except maybe at Apple, but I think everybody in the U.S. federal government, except maybe at the Commerce Department, you know, if you put them under sodium pentothal, they would say this should be done under a statutory regime that's designed for the complexity of modern communications technologies. The All Writs Act is a function of people not having the tools legally that they need to do the things that there are investigative exigencies that require them to do. And I don't think anybody, certainly nobody serious, would say this is something without collateral consequences, this is something, you know, that you would choose to do in an ideal world. And, you know, remember, and I say this with some defensiveness, because when Comey did this, he came to Brookings and did it in a conversation with me. And so I actually have a sense of what he was trying to do when he started this conversation. And if you go back to what he said in the fall of, I guess it was 2014, he said, look, we have a problem, and we don't really know what the right answer to it is, but we need to start a conversation about that. About this. And the response that he got, I think, from the unified, not quite unified, but from a wide swath of the Silicon Valley community is, okay, here's, you can take your conversation, Jason, put in where the moon don't shine. And I think there's a, you know, there are process implications of that, that eventually, you know, the problem catches up with people and they feel like they have to do something, and they look at the U.S. federal code and they say, okay, what are the tools we have? And, you know, what you've got is the technical assistance provisions of Title III, FISA, and CALEA, and you've got the All Writs Act, and those are some interesting pegs and they have interesting shapes, and you're going to start shoving those pegs into holes, whether they're the same shape or not. And I think that's really the answer to your question. No one will make an argument for this in principle. At least nobody should.
Okay. More questions.
Hi, Gabriel. I work on the Hill. I do not have a question, which is the worst way to start a panel discussion in DC. I will go back to a previous question, which is somebody asked, is there a way to measure the extent to which this is a problem? And the answer is yes. And to a caveated extent, it is already happening, which is that the U.S. federal court system does track wiretaps, and they do track to the extent since the mid-1990s or so, cases in which they have encountered encryption and the number of cases to which that encryption is not breakable. So the caveat being that this does not include FISA cases, but to the extent that the federal criminal courts and non-FISA cases come across encryption, the answer is that there are a mid-single-digit number of cases every year where there are wiretaps. The cases in which they encounter encryption are in the low double digits, and the cases in which there is unbreakable encryption is occasionally zero, and usually in the very low single digit of cases.
So I've seen that, and I think that understates the problem quite substantially.
Right, exactly, which is why one way to look at this problem is to simply say that those numbers should be expanded to the extent that, you know, we should understand the problem, that those numbers should be published to the extent that they should be. So, for example, the Hill could look at them. Just to understand the extent to which that is a problem.
I think the difficulty with it is not publishing the numbers, but it doesn't account for the chilling effect that encryption has on law enforcement investigative tactics. Practically every website that matters, except those of us who don't like being bullied by Chris Segoyan, has moved to SSL, TLS. Certainly if you have something that you think somebody might steal in transit, you would want to do TLS encryption, which means that from the computer to the website is an encrypted link. That used to be a very productive place to do wiretaps and to take information, both for U.S. law enforcement and for foreign law enforcement. There's no point anymore. There's no point in getting a wiretap for that communication because you're not going to be able to break the encryption. And so people go looking for something else. There's really not much point in serving a wiretap order on most of the electronic messaging services that have gone to end encryption because you know what the answer is going to be. Thank you for your order. I can't do anything for you. Well, nobody wastes their time getting paperwork that in the end isn't going to produce anything. So my sense on that is the only time they record the fact that they've encountered encryption and that it's thwarted their investigation is when they're surprised to encounter encryption. If they know they're likely to, then they probably aren't going to choose that method of investigation.
Hi, my name is Doug. I'm an avid listener. I was wondering, when you spoke about how, I guess, the fact that DOJ is relying on the All Writs Act here means that the problem is crying out for a legislative fix, what are some of the provisions that you would want to see in that kind of legislation? And relatedly, in one of the recent Rational Security episodes, you talked about some conversations that we're having about FISA reauthorization in a year or two. I'm not sure exactly when that's happening. And do you think that this conversation is going to come up in the context of FISA as well?
All right, that's you.
So those are excellent questions. So on your first question, the honest answer is I don't really know what the right legislative approach is at this stage. And that's why I've actually never taken the position, not because I'm being coy, I've never taken the position that, you know, there needs to be a performance standard in which companies have to be able to decrypt. I've never taken the view that I've sort of tried to explore a bunch of policy options without ever saying, here's what I think the right answer is, because I honestly don't know. I think the question is genuinely hard, and there's a lot, and a lot of different entities and interests have a lot of reasonable equities in the conversation. That said, here's some things I think are ridiculous. And you might, and I think if
now we're down to it. Right, this is what we're good at.
I think if you may be able to cull where I end up from the list of things I think are ridiculous. So here's something I think is ridiculous. Ungoverned spaces suck. Okay, and when we call them Yemen or the tribal areas of Pakistan, nobody says, ah, what a great thing, human liberty, Somalia, right? Nobody makes an ideological argument for a zone of lawlessness. But somehow when you call it the internet, and the thing that makes it lawless is the fact that there's no identity verification of anybody, and you can't find out what people are doing because everything's encrypted end-to-end in an unbreakable fashion, even with a warrant. People talk about that as a triumph of human liberty. That's nonsense. Let's start with that. Number two, here's another thing that's nonsense. We have given the tech companies, back in the late 1990s, we gave them the most amazing gratuity that Congress has given to any interest group of any kind in probably since the baseball antitrust exemption. And that was, we gave them CDA 230. And CDA 230 said, a tech platform cannot be held liable for anything that any of its third-party users do, as long as it did not specifically editorial contribute to it. So to give you an idea of how weird that is, when I worked for the Washington Post, we could be held liable for a libelous ad that we ran. That's, you know, New York Times v. Sullivan, right, was over an ad, not over the content of the New York Times. The New York Times.com or the Washington Post.com cannot be held liable for a libelous ad. That's how powerful, and all of the modern internet companies are built on the backs of this liability protection. So we've said to them, okay, you are hereby immune for anything your users do on your platform. Now, can you please help us investigate the conduct of your users on your platform for which you are immune? And their answer is, No, thanks. And I think that basic trade is implausible in a world in which you actually, somebody has to be responsible for investigating and policing what people are doing on these platforms. So I think, you know, that idea that you're immune and you don't have to help doesn't work. And then finally, here's one last thing, and this, you know, betray my anger at Apple today. You know, Apple issued a statement that said, we take what the FBI does very seriously, but. And what comes after the but is, we don't take it so seriously that it means anything against our device security. And, you know, I don't believe in device security over everything else in the world. So the question, that, you know, I don't know whether that leads you to, all right, I think the answer is a backdoor performance requirement or relax CDA 230 immunity for people who don't do something. But I do believe there is a civic obligation on the part of tech companies to not let their systems be used in fashions that are profoundly destructive of society. And I think it boggles my mind that that's a controversial proposition.
So I have to say, it wasn't just that they said they had respect for the FBI, but they said, we have no sympathy for terrorists.
Oh, right.
But. Really, when you're saying we have no sympathy for terrorists, when you feel you have to say that, you've already lost most of your audience.
But as you pointed out before, query whether they have, or whether their vision of where the public is, you know, whether the public is profoundly uncommunitarian in their desire to have, you know, tech companies that represent their privacy interests. And I don't know the answer to that question, but I think we are at a moment where we're going to start finding out.
So Jonathan Zittrain wrote a book called The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, if I remember. And his,
good book.
And one of his theories was, and Tim Wu has said much the same, that gradually with new technologies, they are colonized by successful oligopolists. And the oligopolists gradually accommodate themselves to government in ways that coincidentally create barriers to entry for new competitors. And we may be starting to see that. Indeed, I think the whole principle behind Section 230, which used to be globally recognized, is increasingly viewed as a peculiarity of American law. Other countries are quite happy saying, oh, Twitter, you can't have hate speech. What are you talking about? And we'll hold you liable for what these right-wingers are saying. And they have had to learn to start policing their users in ways that please governments around the world. And that means a gradual accommodation, loss of 230 effectively. And so the question for the U.S. is, on what terms are people going to lose their 230 protection here as well? Next question.
You had a question, right?
Hi, I'm Sarah. I work for a UK-based NGO that tracks political violence. My question is about countering violent extremism, and I'm wondering to what extent the new State Department policy on CVE is separating the military's role in CVE on the ground and the role in Washington using social media and other forms. In particular, I'm wondering to what extent is it possible to separate CVE in the Middle East from Washington, and what are some of the strategies we can do to make that more successful?
Cameron?
It's a great question. I think that there are a couple of bureaucratic drivers here that we have to be upfront about. The first, of course, is that since 9/11, the Pentagon and the intelligence community have demonstrated an ability to innovate, to generate new tools, to apply them in effective ways against the cherished threat. And the civilian side of the executive branch has kind of struggled to keep up. There was a lot of discussion of this at the beginning of the Obama administration about authorities and funds that have flowed to the Pentagon that both the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State felt should flow back in the other direction. And the buildup of the theory of the case for civilian CVE, I think, has been a slow process in the State Department, but it's definitely part of that bureaucratic effort. The one piece I think that has been the most challenging is the communications piece. And the State Department has tried a lot of different models or different approaches in doing counter-messaging or counter-narrative without demonstrating a lot of success, I think, you know, partly because it's a very hard problem, but partly because the State Department hasn't been able to go out into the field and apply tools in local languages, in local contexts. The military has a lot of capabilities around the world to do comms, and it's built those capabilities up over the last couple of decades in a bunch of different contexts, and so it could kind of leap into that space, and it's not going to give it up because it sees comms as an important part of its overall operations and its overall toolbox. So I think the communications piece and the State Department's Global Engagement Center is probably the hardest place to draw the line. But one of the messages I took away from Tony Blinken's speech is that that is not the main focus of the State Department effort, that the main focus is in the programming that is out in communities, helping social institutions and religious institutions and local governments push back against people who are trying to radicalize young people, recognize people who are at risk and kind of wrap them in a warm embrace and deal with underlying grievances and things like that, which is the sweet spot for the civilian infrastructure in the State Department. The risk, though, is that CVE then becomes an umbrella, bureaucratic umbrella, for everything good that the State Department wants to do out there in those communities.
So let me offer a couple of ideas. We probably don't need more GS-14s tweeting.
This is the list of things Stuart thinks are ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. It's shorter, though. What I think is interesting is that it's now been 15 years since 9/11, and we brought all our technology for countering terrorism up to date as of 2001. What has happened since 2001 is the social media revolution, and that we have not figured out how to engage social media in dealing with counterterrorism. But I have two or three thoughts on that. Social media, coming up with content for social media is really hard, as witness all those GS-14s locked in the basement of the State Department. And it's unlikely to be enormously effective. Deprecating content is a lot easier and maybe more effective. It is something that government and social media does all the time. They say there are some tweets you all want to get and some tweets you don't care about, and we will serve you the stuff that you should want, that you do want, and finding ways to start taking messages that directly counter some of the violent extremism in effective ways, because you can see what's effective by A/B testing it, and then start serving the more successful messages and getting the cooperation of the social media companies to do that. That's a new approach that I think is more likely to be effective than the things we've talked about thus far. And then my last idea is social media is obviously a great recruiting tool, social media also allows you to see where that message is going, who's receptive to the message, and then to identify all the people who are retweeting those messages, and remarkably, because it's social media, all their moms. And you can go and talk to their moms about what their kids are tweeting, and that for 60-70% of the people who've been tweeting, that's the last tweet they're going to send on that topic. It's a brilliant solution to as a way of countering violent extremism. So that's my proposal. I'm going to call that the Mom Squad.
It's the Mom Empowerment CVE strategy.
Last question.
Good evening. My name is Catherine Davis. I'm a law clerk. Earlier,
the panel mentioned a growing analogy between smartphones and the judicial protection of the home as a man's castle in the American tradition. I'd love to hear the panel unpack what you think of that analogy.
I think of my smartphone as more like my purse. You know, there are a lot of things that a woman puts into the purse over the course of the day. She doesn't clean it out very often. There are many things she would not like other people to see her carrying around in her purse. So I think that might be a better analogy.
When I first met my husband, he referred to a smartphone as a digital shackle, I think was the word that was used. And I like to actually think of my home as a refuge, and my phone is almost like a burden. But, yeah, I mean, to Tamara's point, I mean, I'm increasingly terrified by all the things that I find on the phone that I didn't know I put there, or texts that I didn't know I sent, or impertinent things that I sent. And, I mean, I feel more protective about the phone in some ways than I do my own house, because if you came into my house, it would take you a while to poke around there and, put my trail together and do my profile on my phone. It would take you about, 5 minutes.
So, about a year ago, I wrote a paper with a young woman named Jane Chong reflecting on the possibility that we were actually really cyborgs, and that the difference between the cyborg who has this thing implanted inside the head and us is really not that great. We're completely glued to it. I don't think the home is the right analogy. The right analogy is your brain, that when you do not have this, when you're not at home, you don't feel naked or that something's missing or that your, arm's been cut off. But think about the last time you didn't have your phone, and it wasn't because you chose to be in a refuge, right? It was because, you'd left it somewhere and you felt cut off and disconnected and there was something really wrong.
Isn't that more psychological? Like, we're all monkeys hitting the bar to get another piece of food?
There's undoubtedly a component of that, but I think there's also a fact that we are less independent organisms than we think we are now, and the unit is this. That is the person and the machine in integration with one another, not simply the person. And so I'm not convinced that the home is the right. I think the Schwarzenegger is the right metaphor.
So I can only say this is your brain, but this, pointing to the audience, is your brain on Lawfare.
Woo! And Rational Security.
Thank you all. This has been a terrific presentation.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.